Welcome to Walk in the Shadows with me, your host, Tim Woolworth. This is episode one of the third series of our podcast. There are many things that unite us as humans, like the air we breathe, the food we eat, and the blood that pumps through each of us. Your blood and mine can be traced back for countless generations to the pre-dawn of humanity. We say things that give our blood power, like if you have a passion that you're good at. One might say that, for example, dancing is in her blood. When something requires a lot of effort, we say it took blood, sweat, and tears. And of course, we recognize that our very lives depend on the power of blood when we acknowledge our life's blood that flows within us. Blood has been studied by medical science for centuries. Medical science understands the nature of blood, how it works, and how it keeps us alive. One thing that cannot be looked at under a microscope is the magical power humanity has imbued into blood. There have been countless rituals over the centuries that have utilized blood. Whether it is an invitation to join an esoteric group, or even something as simple as becoming a blood brother or sister with your best friend as a child. Blood unites us all. Both in occult studies and magical rituals, there is something known as a sympathetic link. This is where something physical is used to magically represent something else, much like a mystical metaphor. With blood, it represents our life force. There is a sympathetic link between the two, and this has been recognized since at the very least biblical times. Our very lives require the circulation of blood flow. When someone bleeds, their life force is sapped. Throughout the millennia, it has been said that something is preying upon our blood, draining our very life force. Humanity has given this predator many names. We fear this monster. It creates a sympathetic link with its victims. It gains power from the victim's blood, and in some cases, this beast can infuse power into their victims. We have devised ways to protect ourselves. We have invented means to eliminate this stalker of humanity, which is not an easy task because over time, this stalker has gained almost mythical powers. It has thrived in literature and film as this predator represents some of our darkest fears. What happens when you don't own your own blood, your very own life force? In this series, we are going to explore the dark mystery that is the vampire. This series will start with some historical vampire cases and move on to other tangential areas like energy vampires, and even modern vampires that walk among us today. It should be noted that there are fascinating legends of the vampire found in most areas of the world. In this episode, we are going to primarily feature the traditional lore of the vampire from the Western world perspective, as that is what most of our listeners think of when the word vampire is heard. If this topic intrigues you and you need to hear more, there are bonus episodes in this series that only shadow people have access to. With all topics we cover, the Walk in the Shadows bonus episodes expand upon the concepts in each season. To gain access to our bonus episodes and several other perks like free merchandise, please visit the Shadow Realm for more information. The link is in the show notes. If I may have one more ask before we get to the good stuff, like and subscribe to our podcast. If you really vibe with what we're doing, please leave a review and tell a friend or two. We really do appreciate it. As a side note, when we discuss vampirism, there will be discussions of blood, viscera, and murder. If you are sensitive to these topics, please be advised. And now, let's begin digging into the vampiric mystery.
Thank you.
I say the word vampire, chances are that you see an image, an archetypal legend, if you will, in your mind's eye. The vampire is pale, most often male, who dresses in dark clothes, sleeps in a coffin, and has very large, pointy teeth for drawing blood. This is the image that has been ascribed to vampires mainly due to one character, Dracula from the eponymous fictional book written by Bram Stoker that was published in 1897. While not the first book on vampires, it was by far the most influential. Stoker brilliantly blended a historical figure with lore from vampire culture that long predated Count Dracula. The name Dracula came from a real person, Vlad Dracula. Dracula's father was named Vlad Dracul, which means Vlad the Dragon, a name derived from a military group of soldiers called the Order of the Dragon, who fought against Turkish invasions on Christian countries. His son, the Vlad that Stoker based his character upon, had the surname Dracula as opposed to Dracul like his father. Adding the suffix letter A to the name meant son of. So when all this was taken into consideration, Vlad Dracula's name literally meant Vlad, son of the dragon. When Dracula took over as king of Wallachia, he garnered the name Vlad Tepes, which when translated, defined the name that he would become infamous for, Vlad the Impaler. Wallachia is now part of Romania, and it was under Vlad's rule from 1456 to 1477. During his reign, to say he had a bad temperament is a massive understatement. Enemy soldiers, along with anyone whom Vlad disagreed with for any reason, and any criminal that was found guilty in Wallachia, was impaled upon a tall stake driven into the ground. The horrible part was that the person was alive when they were impaled. The stake had either a sharp point or a blunted point if Dracula was feeling particularly malicious and wanted to prolong the agony. The end of the stake was inserted into a genital orifice of the victim. The weight of the person would draw them down upon the stake, very slowly killing them. When the victims were dead, Vlad left the bodies on the stakes for all to see, enemy soldiers and citizens alike. Stakes weren't the only way that the son of the dragon killed. There are several horror stories about this beast that you can look up, but the one horrific event that really illustrates who the Impaler was must be the time he invited all the crippled, poor, sick, elderly and beggars to a massive feast. There was an amazing spread of food laid out for them, complete with wine and dessert. Once the indigents were inside the building and gorging themselves, soldiers promptly nailed the front door shut and barred the windows with wood. They then set torches to the building, killing everyone inside while Vlad watched. During his reign, Vlad the Impaler's bloodlust resulted in over 100,000 people being killed both in Wallachia and neighboring countries where he went to battle. One country where he conducted battle, as I'm sure you've already guessed, was Transylvania, the country directly north of Wallachia in present-day Romania. Vlad Dracula viewed all humanity as dispensable, and it seemed that he could never quell his bloodlust. Stoker captured this brilliantly in his version of the vampire. Bram Stoker put some fantastic flourishes on the legend of the vampire when writing the book. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend Dracula for your reading pleasure. The book is as timeless as the countless movies that have been made based upon the characters of Dracula, Jonathan Harker, Mina, Renfield, and of course the vampire slayer himself, Van Helsing. Yet we must keep in mind, the legend of the vampire is much older than Stoker's Dracula. This series is about separating facts from literary fiction. The written accounts we will be primarily studying, especially the historical ones, were not written as fiction. They were written to preserve what the writer observed as cultural fact. These observations were designed to be read in a library for subsequent generations to learn from. If we are going to talk about writing about vampires as a preservation of culture, We should probably start at the beginning to give you an idea of the time frame we are talking about. The first written accounts of vampires go back between 4,000 and 5,000 years ago, where warnings about vampires were preserved, quite literally, in clay tablets with cuneiform writing. I am speaking, of course, about ancient Mesopotamia, where the Sumerians wrote of two types of vampires, named Enedimu, or translated as an Ekimu sometimes, had a genesis that mirrored what later cultures believe. The Enedimu was created after someone suffered a curse, had an unredeemed sin, or suffered violent death and was not buried in consecrated ground. The Enedimu were not physical vampires in the traditional sense, but they aligned with the non-physical vampire type that this particular episode covers. The Enedimu were phantom-like and walked the earth, looking for victims. When they found a household, they would torment the victims to psychically feed off of their suffering and could only be expelled by a priest. They were able to walk through doors and walls. They attacked the household through
evil wind gusts,
which is important because Sumerian mythology equates wind to a psychic and or a magical force. The second type of Mesopotamian vampire found in some of the oldest writings of humanity is called an Uruku, or as some scholars have translated, Utuku. When the cuneiform description of the Uruku was translated into English, it literally means
vampire which attacks man.
The warning the cuneiform imparts is that by simply looking into an Uruku's eyes, a human can be injured. They were often found in graveyards, mountains, and other abandoned places such as the sea. There isn't much more that has survived about the Uruku, but the fact that the translation gives us the word vampire and that they attack man is fascinating. If you are interested in learning more, Egypt, India, Babylonia, Greece, China, and a host of other ancient cultures all have vampiric creatures that you can research. Over millennia, since these first written accounts of vampires, there have been cases of vampirism that have been observed and commented upon by credible witnesses. Since we are exploring the actual lore of the vampire based upon events and not fictionalized books, we have to ask a simple question to begin this exploration of vampire cases. What exactly is a vampire? There are two overarching categories of vampires, physical and non-physical. Those two categories are broken down further. Under the physical vampire category, we find two types, mortal and immortal blood-drinking vampires. In the non-physical vampirism category, there are intentional and unintentional psychic vampires. We will explore each of these subcategories throughout this series to leave you much more prepared, just in case you should hear quiet tapping on your window at night from something that wants to be let in. In answering the question of what a vampire is and how we arrived at the idea of the vampire we have today, we have to start by considering some early authorities on the topic. One such resource is Heinrich Zopfius, who wrote in his 1733 vampire dissertation that
vampires issue forth from their graves at night, attack people sleeping quietly in their beds, suck out all their blood from their bodies, and destroy them. They beset men, women, and children alike, sparing neither age nor sex. Those who are under the fatal malignity of their influence complain of suffocation and a total deficiency of spirits, after which they will soon expire. Some who, when at the point of death, have been asked if they can tell what is causing their decease, reply that such and such persons, lately dead, have arisen from the tomb to torment and torture them.
When we consider Zopfius's description of the vampire, we are firmly placed with the idea of the vampire as a physical being that attacks others, sucking their blood, and ultimately killing them. These are the traits of a vampire with which most of us are familiar. A more modern scholar that you should be aware of is Montague Summers. His name is synonymous with vampire research. He set out to be the foremost vampirologist in the world, and he managed to do just that after dedicating decades of his life to researching and writing about vampires in the early 20th century. You might not be familiar with Summers' writings, but his work helped codify the vampire lore as we know it today. It was Summers who made it his life's work to
set forth what may be termed as the philosophy of vampirism, and however ghastly and macabre they appear, I have felt that here one must not tamely shrink from a careful consideration of the many passions and circumstances which throughout the ages have played a part in consolidating the vampire legend, and in perpetuating the tradition among darker and more secret mysteries of belief that prevail in the heart of man.
Summers was convinced that the vampire was physical and undead. He wrote that the vampire was not a demon nor a ghost. His reasoning behind this is that neither demons nor ghosts possess a physical body, but a vampire certainly does as an undead entity. Summers succinctly described this when he penned that,
"The vampire has a body, and it is his own body. He is neither dead nor alive, but living in death. He is an abnormality, the androgyne in the phantom world, a pariah among the fiends."
Yet this idea of the vampire being physical is a troublesome issue for others. Whereas Zupfius and Summers agreed that the vampire was undead and physical, the few cases they point to are a rare example. Moreover, Summers' work was rife with vampiric heterodoxy in trying to prove the vampire had a physical form. There are centuries of reports from witnesses who have experienced the vampire as a spirit entity that inflicted wounds upon, or even killed, the living. The reports of these phantom-like vampires far outweigh the reports of physical vampires during Summers' years of vampire scholarship. What I found astonishing was that these phantom-like vampires did not drink blood. Instead, the early Western vampires of countries like Greece or Slavic nations feasted primarily upon that sympathetic link with blood, life force. There are so many cases where phantom-like vampires climb into bed with the victim and throttled them to death or left them physically drained of energy. The non-physical vampire was often familiar to its victims, typically being a deceased loved one or a neighbor. The person can sometimes recall who the vampire was only after the attack. This is because the phantom-like vampire typically assumed a dark form in the victim's bedroom, with the facial features of the vampire only manifesting mere moments before the attack. As a side note, I came across the phrase
"throttling someone"
quite a lot when reading historical vampire cases. When I mention the word throttling in this series, it means to choke or to strangle, which is an interesting idea when we consider how the modern blood-drinking vampire attacks its victims. The idea of a vampire throttling its victims is very old. In the 12th century, a chronicler by the name of William of Newburgh wrote of a vampire that was in Buckinghamshire, England. Newburgh was told this tale by a local archdeacon, and he wrote about it under the title of
The Extraordinary Happening When a Dead Man Wandered Abroad Out of His Grave.
In this chronicle, a man was buried. On the night following his interment, he returned to his wife's bed and throttled her. It happened again on the subsequent night as well. For the third night, the wife asked some neighbors to stay at her home. When the vampire appeared, they shouted at it until it went away. Then, as things often do, the events became more prolific. The vampire ghost attacked animals and alarmed neighbors with his presence. He was referred to as a
ghost
and not a corporeal body because only a select few could see him, whereas most could not, but still
perceptibly felt his horrible presence.
The archdeacon consulted the bishop, Hugh of Lincoln, who had decided that the best option was to disinter the body and place an absolution upon its chest. When they dug up the body, it was observed as being uncorrupt despite the months that had passed since his death. The absolution was placed on his chest, and he was reburied. And afterwards, there were no more vampire ghost attacks. We will move forward now to the 17th and 18th centuries, when vampire hysteria was abound in Slavic countries. There were so many reports of vampiric attacks and exhumations to prevent or end these attacks that scholars have a name for this vampiric era:
Magia Posthuma,
or roughly translated, posthumous magic. There are several surviving accounts of vampires afflicting local villages, including the way that they attacked people and how they were dispatched. These cases helped form the basis of the vampire legends we have today, and they are the legends Bram Stoker based his vampire around. There are a lot of words for vampire. Each country has their own descriptor, starting with the word vampir from the ancient Magyars to the Strigon of Slavic countries. One such Strigon was named Yuri Grando of Croatia. And Yuri may just be the first vampire named in historical records. Yuri Grando was a villager in Kringa, and we know almost nothing of his life, but he was most certainly famous in death. Grando died in 1656 due to an unspecific illness and was buried by the village priest, Father Giorgio. Soon after his death, Grando arose from his grave and would terrorize the village by wandering around and knocking on the doors of certain houses. There's a reason for this. The people living in that area of Croatia believed that there was a type of vampire called a Strigon. During a Strigon's living years, they were sorcerers that feasted upon the blood of small children. Upon death, they became a Strigon, an undead creature that was cursed to walk around their village around midnight to knock on the doors of houses where someone would die within a few hours. You may be asking yourself where the vampire part comes in. It was said that if a person died during a Strigon period of wandering, it was thought that the life force of that person was consumed by the vampiric sorcerer. Grando wandered around his village for 16 years as a portent of death, looking for the next life force to feast upon. Occasionally, a Strigon would also find his way into bedrooms and terrorize women while they slept. The Strigon Grando was no different. A widow awoke to see Grando in her bedroom. He looked preserved and fresh after 16 years, but still eerily corpse-like. The Strigon then proceeded to sexually assault her. This was the final straw for the village after enduring over a decade and a half of his torment. The residents took things into their own hands, and a group of 9 men was assembled, led by the mayor. They went to Grando's grave and saw that his body was whole, preserved, and smiling. Father Giorgio, one of the 9 men, attempted to rid the Strigon through an invocation. He held up a crucifix and exclaimed boldly,
"Look, Strigon, there is Jesus Christ who saved us from hell and died for us. And you, Strigon, cannot have peace."
It didn't work. The Strigon continued to knock on doors, looking for a feast of life force. The men returned. They took a sharpened hawthorn stick and tried to stab the vampire in the heart with a stake. They failed as the stake could not pierce the body. Then one man in the group used an axe, or a saw depending upon which version of the lore is being told, to behead the Strigon. The vampire cried out loudly, and then blood poured from the neck. The head was removed, and the grave was covered in dirt once more, permanently entombing the Strigon and ensuring his undead death. Only then did the village know what it was like to sleep peacefully without a vampire knocking upon their doors. The next case we'll cover also adds to the lore that we still assign to vampires today, half a century later, because much like the vampires we grew up with as portrayed in various media, Arnold Palvel, once he turned into a vampire, was able to convert others into creatures of the night. Palvel was a soldier in the Serbian army in the early 1700s. When he was in Kosovo, he was attacked by a vampire. In that day and age, The only cure to keep a vampire at bay was to eat some dirt from the vampire's grave and smear oneself with blood from the vampire. Pavel proclaimed he did these things, but it is not clear how he knew which grave was the vampire's, nor how he obtained the blood. The important part is, he no longer suffered from vampiric attacks. Pavel returned home to the Serbian village of Medvegia in 1727, and within weeks, he died after falling off a hay wagon and was buried after the appropriate time had been set aside for viewing. In less than a month after his death, the vampiric attacks began. Villagers began to report that Pavel was throttling them at night in their beds. 4 villagers died. Fearing that Pavel was a vampire, they dug up his grave to check for signs of vampirism. He was undecayed, odor-free, and his skin and nails had fallen off, only to be replaced by new iterations. There was fresh blood to be found inside the chest cavity, and it streamed from the orifices when a wooden stake was put through his heart. Upon staking, the vampire groaned and blood poured forth. He was removed and his body burned. There was not another vampiric attack linked to Pavel, but the villagers feared that those he attacked would become vampires. They dug up each one of their graves and found them all in the same condition as Pavel, several weeks after death. They were all disposed of in the same manner. Considerable time went by, several years in fact, when 17 additional people died in what appeared to be vampiric attacks. This was naturally linked to Pavel, and the villagers felt that one of Pavel's vampires must have escaped exhumation. The Pavel case doesn't end there. In fact, it becomes quite exceptional when of the 17 people, over a dozen of them were exhumed by military doctors in Pavel's village with the condition of each body being described in detail. In their testimonial, there was physical evidence of throttling. Some of the observations are unsettling. There were undecayed, complete organs after months of lying in the ground. The vampire responsible for the attacks is also identified and exhumed. It really is a case that makes one think twice about the vampire legend. There is way too much to include here, so if you want to hear the entirety of the Arnold Pavel case, there is a bonus episode for our shadow people to listen to. After this short break, we will cover one more vampire case from the 18th century, this time in the small village of Kiselova, Hungary. Phantom-like vampire case is that of Peter Plogoyevich. This case is taken from eyewitness reports from Imperial Provisor Frumbold, an Austrian administrator of the region who wrote letters about this vampiric case that still exists, and a parish priest. Peter Plogoyevich died in 1725 and was buried with a religious funeral about 10 weeks after he was put in the ground. Several villagers reported seeing him at night. Much like the other cases, his vampire ghost came upon his victims in bed and attacked them. Over the course of a week, 9 people died from his attacks. Those that did not die immediately claim that Plogoyevich attacked them. Upon death, many victims showed signs of suffocation. Frumbold wrote that
Peter Plogoyevich came to them in his sleep and lay down on them and choked them that they would now have to give up the ghost.
The villagers wanted to banish the vampire to eternal rest by staking the body. Frumbold, at first, wanted the citizens to hold off. The burning of a corpse as a way to rid a village of vampires was forbidden by a 14th century law, Article 20 in fact, of Dušan's Code, a constitution for Serbia ratified in 1349. That stated,
"And if any person be taken out of his grave for magic and be burnt, any village that does this shall pay a fine, and if any priest shall come to it, let his priesthood be taken from him."
Removing a body to burn a vampire, a creature of magic, was punishable for all involved. Finally, after a long council with the parish priest, Frumbold changed his stance on the vampire's exhumation when pressured by the villagers. It was either break the law or become a victim of the vampire of Kisilova. When the vampire was exhumed, the telltale signs of a vampire were present. He was undecomposed, odor-free, and there was new hair growth along with new skin and nails. What really shocked the villagers was that there was fresh blood in his mouth.
After opening the coffin, they saw that the deceased's body was undecomposed, as if it had been buried a few hours ago, not 10 weeks ago. After being pierced with a hawthorn stalk, fresh, red blood flowed from Peter's body, nose, and ears. Then the body was burned while the priest read the prayers.
As you might have guessed, the vampire attacks ceased after this event. All of these vampire attacks seem to drain a person's life force, but rarely the blood of the victims. There was no corporeal body to the vampires while they attacked, but there was a phantasm-like vampire that could interact with the living. As a final note, there have been several references to the bodily state of the exhumed. I had no reference point for this in judging the accuracy of these reports, so I dug a bit deeper into this topic and exhumed a PDF chapter of a book that was originally published by researchers at Georgetown University. This PDF chapter, entitled
Decomposition of the Body and Efforts to Slow Its Disintegration,
describes, in full, the stages of decomposition and the timeframes for each stage. If you read it, you will have a better understanding of the fresh blood, new skin and nails, and the fresh-looking, flushed faces that were reported. And if you listen to the bonus episode on Pavel, you might just question the authenticity of vampires when you compare the observations by medical doctors on the state of the organs on all the village vampires that were exhumed versus the time they spent in the ground. We have posted this PDF in the Shadow Realm as a downloadable document for all listeners if you are interested in pursuing additional knowledge about this topic. This episode was researched and written by me, Tim Woolworth. The final audio engineering and creative soundscapes are from my fellow explorer of the unknown, Joshua Sean of Zero G ITC. Hopefully this episode made a little bit of our paranormal world more normal for you. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe and review our podcast. As always, if you have any personal anecdotes, observations, or alternate explanations you would like to share on this or any other topic we've covered, or just maybe you would like to drop a note to tell us about any encounters you've had with the supernatural, you can always reach us via our email, contact@walkintheshadows.com. Once again, that's contact, spelled contact, @walkintheshadows.com. If you want to learn more about this podcast or myself, please visit our Walk in the Shadows website. The link is in the show notes. On our website, you can find stunning merchandise available only through the Walk in the Shadows store, the resources used for this series, all of our social media accounts, and access to our Shadow Realm where the Shadow People walk freely. When you enter our Shadow Realm, you help us keep high-quality, paranormal content delivered regularly to the podcast player of your choice. Finally, thank you for your time spent walking in the shadows with me. I know your time is valuable, so I really appreciate you being here, in this moment. Until next episode, may you and yours be healthy, prosperous, and treated with kindness by everyone and everything you meet, both in the light and in the shadows.